So it's very exciting. So I was asked here to tell everyone about this technique, give an experimental overview of how we measure forces within cell sheet. And what I'm going to do is not only give you an overview of this technique, but also tell you what are the new things that we learn from this technique, and also what are the open questions that people here might be interested in. So this is the team that is behind different several aspects of this work. Jeff Fredberg and Jim Butler are the senior members of the lab, and Chavi, that many of you here know, was postdoc in the lab, and he is the one who started collective migration studies in the lab. So let's proceed. So why do we care? Why do we study this collective cell migration? Many of you know that there are important processes in biology like organ development, wound healing, cancer metastasis. In these type of processes, cells exhibit collective migration. What you are seeing here is MDCK cell sheet. They are doing this collective migration in vitro on an elastic substrate made up of polyacrylamide. Now, in this system, the question that has been around for a while is, what do these cells do? Do they apply any forces to the substrate or to their neighbors when they are migrating? And how these forces are related to the collective motion that you see, or whether there is at all any relationship. And this question remained unsolved for about 100 years, and this technique, monolayer stress microscopy, has now made this question accessible to experimental investigation.
That's the question.
Yes.
The bright spots are dividing cells, right?
Yes, the bright spots are dividing.
So, whatever, I asked the question, the experimentalist, whether cell division is usually important on the time scales of the experiments, which are pretty long. And they always say no. But here we see.
Yes, I will come to that point. I will come to that point. So I will be invoking that point several times in the talk.
I mean, cell division wouldn't be particularly important with respect to collective migration.
Well, if there is enough growth and cells multiply, one could imagine that this is one of the effects that is pushing the front forward. I mean,
so let me give you.
Probably not. I agree that probably not.
So let me give you a short answer to that. So in terms of the area increase of this island, there is, if you count how many cell division has happened, the amount of area increase and the number of cell division, there is decent amount of area increase which can be associated to cell division. But when it comes to cells pushing, that does not happen. Let me come to that. So when the cells are migrating on the substrate, let me show you what they do to the substrate. Okay, and this is work that Chavi did. I will tell you how these forces are measured, but what you are going to see is that on the left panel, you will see a monolayer that will migrate from the top edge, and it will migrate to the bottom edge. And as this migration is going on the right panel, you will see force being plotted, the force that the cells apply on this spot. The substrate is polyacrylamide gel.
Flexing while he's
yes.
in motion?
Yes.
How, is it like a thick substrate that's like jello?
100 microns. I'll come to that. Yeah. So before the monolayer comes to that spot, what you see there is a noise floor interaction. And then once the monolayer hits that, boom, you see huge fluctuations. And what you must have noticed by now is that if you look at the average forces that are present here, they are much teeny tiny compared to this fluctuation. So the system seems to be dominated by these fluctuating forces. Yes, you had some question?
The force does change sign quite a bit, right? So it's pulling backwards and...
Yes, yes. Now that is also obvious in this graph. So it starts with zero, and you can also see sign change. Now let us look at a map of these forces. So you saw heterogeneity in time. So what about space? So in space, what you see is that there are regions where the cells are applying force towards right. Physically, what it means is that it is grabbing onto the substrate and pulling the sheet forward, which one can understand this. But what is puzzling is that simultaneously, at the same point, you also have locations where the cells are applying forces in the direction of motion. Now, what those blue spots indicate is that perhaps at those locations, cells are resisting moving forward. But still, they are getting swayed by their neighbors along this forward motion. So this study that Chavi did, it kind of suggested that this relationship between physical forces and motion is a rather deep question. It means one doesn't really get any obvious answer by just looking at cell substrate forces.
Sorry, did you mean to say they're pulling on the substrate or pushing on the substrate that gives you different signatures? I didn't quite catch.
So the red spots would be the locations where the cell is pulling onto the substrate. And the blue spots, one can think of that as pushing on the substrate, or they are resisting forward motion, right? That's why you get the reverse sign of force at those blue spots.
And it's not necessarily neighbors around them pulling them in a direction that looks like it's...
That can be, right? That can be. So right now you are just looking at cell-substrate forces. I'll come to those cell-cell forces. And so this question becomes deeper, that how can a force that is so fluctuating be related to motion that is so cooperative. So this is when I finished my PhD in thin film mechanics, and I joined Fredberg lab, and we developed this technique called monolayer stress microscopy, and with which we could quantify the forces that cells exert on their neighbors. And these are the papers upon which the technique is built. What I will do is I will divide this talk in three parts. In the first part, I will show you the work that Chavi did. So before we go there, I want to step back, way back into 1980s, and tell you about a breakthrough that happened, which one can link to this technique, so to put things in proper perspective. So in 1980s, Albert Harris and co-workers, what they did was they took fibroblasts and they put them on rubber silicon. Thin films. And what they found was very surprising, that when the cells are adherent on this substrate, they contact this substrate. You see wrinkling of this substrate. Now, this substrate wrinkling opened a window in cell mechanics, experimental cell mechanics, that by looking at substrate deformation, one can know what sort of physical state the cell is in. This technique eventually matured, and what we nowadays use is polyacrylamide gel. So the gel is about 100 microns thick, and the bottom surface of the gel is attached to glass, and the top surface is functionalized with collagen, and just underneath the top surface there are some fluorescent markers. And any of the experiments that we do typically is composed of taking an image of cell and then we simultaneously take an image of the fluorescent markers. So here what you see in red are the tiny fluorescent markers. And at the end of the experiments, we take out the cells, and then we take another image of these fluorescent markers where the gel is in a relaxed state. So when you compare this final image with any of the earlier images of the bead, you can cross-correlate those and you can find the deformation of the substrate. And from those deformation, we then use Butler algorithm to get tractions that would cause this deformation. So let me just give you a brief view of what this algorithm is. It is nothing but solving this equation, the equilibrium equation for substrate. Now, from deformation, from the substrate deformation, we want forces that would cause that deformation, which is nothing but an inverse boundary value problem. This approach was originally proposed by Micah Dembo, and the work that Jim Butler did is essentially solving this equation in a Fourier space. This Butler approach made this technique like an everyday tool. It is now used widely around the world, and many people have studied this and did modifications. The subsequent developments are here. I believe that these slides will be available in the program website. So you can look up if you're interested in these developments from these slides.
Yeah, Yeah, let me just say, I should have said this at the beginning, just so people know, all talks here are recorded. If you do not want your talk recorded, you should say something. Sorry, go ahead.
So why are you even tracking it from your boundary? Because you see the notes all over the park, right?
So tractions are everywhere, we don't assume that tractions are the boundary.
But you're solving the equation, right? So you don't actually.
So this is solved across the entire gel.
No, because you impose the boundary condition, let's say yj and jxki, right?
Which is at the top surface of the gel.
That's where the cells.
Oh, so n, so, okay.
N is the normal to the gel.
Oh, is it, you're solving this.
Okay, can I, just to let me know, what you measure is the fluorescence intensity. Do you measure through the cells on the top, or do you measure from underneath?
Underneath.
Okay, so what you get is a scalar, which is the intensity of the fluorescence, and from that you get the full tensor.
So what?
Function of position and depth.
That's right. So the image intensity, nothing but it tells us where the bead position is, right? When the cells are deforming the substrate, the bead position would have moved.
Oh, so you're measuring displacement.
So yeah, so when we cross-correlate the two images, what we get is the displacement.
So you have a displacement field. Do you ever just like decorate the gel with parallel lines and parallel lines the other way and like look at displacements on that? You just do the bead positions?
So the beads are randomly distributed. We don't have a pattern.
Initial position and final position for the beads.
Yes.
But you also measure that fluorescence, which is supposed to be proportional to the stress.
No. Fluorescence has nothing to do with stress.
It has not related to stress.
It is not
related. Just measure displacements, that's
exactly, all. Exactly. Yeah?
Sorry, the inverse problem you want to solve is to reduce the forces from the displacement?
So from the displacement one get forces from. Yeah.
The displacement is normal direction between the distinguished step, it's just x, y.
So right now we are looking at XY, and we have given some arguments of why XY would be more important for a cell sheet. For isolated cell, the Z displacements, some people have found that they are important. In cells like dictyostelium and all, the normal displacements are important. But for cell sheet, where the aspect ratio is very small, the sheet is spread way more compared to thickness. So geometric argument tells us that the normal displacements or forces would not be very dominant.
Do you image your beads throughout your block, like in 3D,
with
a single layer at the top?
We just, so what we do is we make sure that there is a very thick and very dense bead just underneath the cell, and we image just that plane.
What I wonder how these forces are related to the direction of motion. Because if you have such an animal which crawls on the belly, and also has legs. When it crawls on the belly, then it forces the medium in the direction of motion. And if it pushes legs, then it forces in the opposite direction.
Yes.
And the cell apparently does both, right?
Yes. That's right.
Yeah, so how you relate then these forces on the substrate with actual motion of the cell?
So what this tells us that the relationship is not obvious from just cell-substrate forces. So let me come and tell you some more of what we further see in the story. So we are still at the very beginning of the story. So this is... So what Chavi did was he didn't just stop at this question that how can these forces which are so fluctuating be related to motion that is so cooperative. What he wanted to do is he wanted to see in these tractions, is there a signature of cooperativity? So for that he did a very simple experiment, which is he took a cell island, big cell island, and then through the cell island he took a strip and then imaged quantified these tractions across the entire strip. So this is left half of the strip, and here you see this cell substrate forces similar to what I've shown you before. What would be surprising is when I show you the second half. Now, in this image, what you will notice is a systematic bias. On the left side, there is more red compared to blue. And eventually, when you go towards the right side, you see more blue compared to red. So this systematic bias is similar to what one would see in a situation like tug of war. So this similarity tells us that perhaps the cell sheet is in a state of tug of war. So what does this physical picture of tug of war teaches us? So let's look at it in slightly deeper. And here what I want to do is I want to take three models of popular models of collective cell migration, and then take those models and see what tug of war has to say about those models. So one model is that proliferation is pushing cell forward, which means that the cell is dividing here, then it pushes its neighbor and then makes room for itself. Now similar event is happening elsewhere, it pushes its neighbor and it makes room for itself. So here cell pushing its neighbor. From tug of war we know that actually cells perhaps are pulling onto their neighbor, not pushing their neighbor. So one can rule this out being a dominant mechanism of monolayer of collective migration. Another mechanism which is very popular is that leader cells are dragging passive followers. It's like a train that you have engine way up in the front, and that engine is dragging everything, whatever is behind it is dragging everything passively. Now from the map I showed you, you saw that each cell way behind the leading edge, the cells were applying forces. So this leader dragging passive followers is not the dominant way in which this collective migration is happening. And finally, there is another model which is each cell moves independently. It's like cars in traffic, that although they are migrating collectively, there is no physical interaction between the neighboring cars. But from tug of war, we know that the cells are actually tugging on their neighbors. So that is also not the big picture. But one very important thing that this tug of war tells us is that there is a cooperative force, which is this tugging force. And maybe that this tugging force is related to collective motion. But how does one obtain this cooperative force? How does one quantify this tugging force, which is basically these intercellular stresses? Now, when I joined the lab, at that time, there were several papers which suggested that this is a very hard problem. One cannot quantify the forces that cells exert on their neighbors. But coming from thin film mechanics, it is very obvious how one can solve this problem. I'll just give you a big picture of how this problem is solved. So if you are interested in detail, please ask questions. I will be happy to answer. So this tug of war picture becomes very useful when it comes to explaining, giving you this big picture. What you have here is that the forces are balanced. This is the most important information that one uses from the system. What do I mean by that is that if you have this ground tractions as 1, 1, 1, then from that, you already know that the tension in the rope is 1, 2, and 3. What we just did is that from the knowledge of this ground tractions, we obtained the tension in the rope. In precisely same way, one can get intercellular stresses. As simple as it is in 1D, in 2D one has to solve this equation, where sigma ij is stresses, intercellular stresses, and the T is substrate tractions. All this has been worked out, and what we get at the end of the day is at every point we get a 2D stress tensor. So we can get what are the normal stresses at that point, and we also get what are the shear stresses at that point. And we can diagonalize this and get principal orientations and quantify anisotropy of these stresses. And there is one more point which I will come back to later, that these principal orientations are also orientations of zero shear stress. And we have done, yeah, go ahead.
I'm just confused because you essentially have two data points, meaning your local stresses at x and at y, and you're getting three variables out of it, the local stress components. Do you need to make additional assumptions like essentially convert Newton balance equations into data on the stresses?
Well, one has to means one considers like Poisson's ratio of the film.
So that is. You need to assume something about.
Yes.
It.
Yes.
It has to be a constant.
Yes, and we have done whether constant or not or what happens. So we have done rigorous validation of this technique, and all those things really do not matter much. We have just last year published those results. So all those things do not matter much.
Following up that, you assume some material. Properties.
Yeah.
So I think, so it seems to me like a strong assumption, like you assume it's a linearly elastic sheet.
That's right.
That's right. But the cells are constantly dividing, so it's not
that's
clear
right.
if it's like a solid.
So at
or
any,
a,
yeah.
Like, so have you done some rheological tests, like, you know, where you can show that it's a solid, so I can assume some, you know, elastic.
That's right. So at any instant of time, the system is in mechanical equilibrium. Okay, so if you are solving for that instant, you don't have to worry about rheology. You don't have to worry about time dependence. You are just balancing forces at that instant of time.
Yeah, but I'm saying that so instead of assuming, let's say, a solid material, I can also assume a liquid-like material, but I'll get the same results in the end because the constructive relations are kind of identical for a viscous medium or so mathematically, it's kind of equivalent.
Yeah, at any instant of time, it is equivalent. At any instant of time, it is equivalent.
Yeah, I have one more question.
Yeah.
I mean, if you do inversion, as you said, you need to assume essentially that you have a homogeneous medium, which is basically a homogeneous solid, but your system probably has very strong fluctuations in rigidity in various other things.
Yes.
Also, it's discrete because it's individual cells studying on each other. So I suppose there is, I mean, you can only really invert this if you make some sort of cross-grained assumptions, right?
So that is right. So we have, in this paper, we have done, we have shown that maybe at the end I will also show you the results from this. But we have shown that homogeneity that people have studied. So people have also measured stiffness. So if we do those type of insert those type of assumptions, we found that the results do not change much. So the results are not very sensitive. The main point here that one has to recognize is that the stresses that we get are very strongly determined by these body forces, right? This cell substrate tractions are essentially body forces. So this solution of this problem is dominated by body forces. So most of these properties, they do not overwhelm any results that one gets from this approach.
Can I ask you one more question?
Yes, absolutely.
After the cells visit the membrane or the substrate and then pass by, does the substrate always return to its initial condition? In other words, there's no permanent plastic deformation.
No.
So everything's linear and reversible.
Yes.
So you get 100% elastic.
Yes.
Response.
Yes.
No plastic.
So we make sure that the substrates, it so happens that the substrates do not undergo huge deformation. And
okay. So what's the largest strain that you observe? Is it like a fraction of a percent?
Yes.
Or, so less than 1%
yes.
strain. And you only measure transverse. You're not measuring up and down, right?
We are not measuring up and down, yeah.
Just from looking at it, do you see any wrinkling or other sign that the transverse displacement is important for that?
Not that we can detect very precisely.
Yeah, but that other picture that you showed us, I was confused whether that was really showing wrinkles or.
Oh, the Harris picture?
Yeah.
Yeah, those are wrinkles. So they have thin membrane, and that thin membrane basically, when the cells attach to it and contract it, they see wrinkles and they quantify those wrinkles, like how those number of wrinkles and the length of wrinkle, and depending on that, they quantify the force.
You think your system has nothing like that? No.
No, no,
okay,
no.
So everything
no.
is just transverse displacement.
Yes.
Less than 1%, everything linear.
Yes. 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 So now with this technique, let us ask some simple questions. One question can be that in this monolayer, if one thinks of the cytoskeletal tension, whether the cytoskeletal tension is smoothly varying is one of the simplest questions that one can ask. So what I'm going to show here is one of the first maps that we looked at, and we were rather surprised by what we saw. So this is anything but smooth. what you see in this map is that there are these huge peaks and valleys, and one can extract some correlation length, and it comes out to be 10 to 15 cells. And if one looks at this peak, what this peak tells you is that there is a location which corresponds to this peak. And in this location, there is some sort of local tug-of-war going on. What else you notice is that the scale bar here is largely tension. Moreover, the mean value...
You actually conclude that you've actually correlated the cytoskeletal tension with the force. Images. I mean, what you're showing here is just an image of cell.
Yes, yes, it's an image.
Actually correlated with the force.
You mean the intensity of anything?
I mean, you say there's a tug of war going on. I don't know whether it's a tug of war if I just look at the cell.
Yes, yes, yes.
Themselves.
You don't know, but what I'm saying is that the physical meaning of the peak is that there is
right.
a tug of war going on.
Okay,
exactly.
So that's what you
exactly.
mean, because
yes.
what you mean is that these are the stresses inside the cell, and they correspond to forces, fractional forces, going the way you showed before.
Yes. So I'm just telling physical meaning of what that peak might mean. And what you see here is that the average magnitude of this force is of the order of magnitude of substrate traction, which means that the cells are applying huge amount of forces on their neighbors. So these are not just touching their neighbors, but they are very actively pulling their neighbors. And so these are not smooth distribution. So what we call this as a rugged stress landscape, that stresses change enormously over short distances. So this rugged stress landscape is not just present in the cells that have free edge, but we found that this is also present when the cells do not have advancing edge. In a confluent state also, they have this type of rugged stress landscape. And what else we found is that one can think that maybe this heterogeneity in stresses is because a cell is very different from its neighbor. There is some heterogeneity of cell phenotype, and maybe that is causing this. But we checked that if you take a homogeneous population of cells, in that also you see that the stresses remain heterogeneous. And the data, yep.
Sorry, can I just clarify, when you say a homogeneous population of cells, by what criteria are they homogeneous?
So these are primary cells that, so we took these cells from University of South Alabama and Troy Stevens lab. So they have some markers that these particular cells express, and all of the cells express those markers, and these are tested that these have similar, these cells are similar phenotype. So the homogeneity is quantified based on some fluorescent protein, some markers that they express.
Do you believe, though, that the heterogeneities that you see in these things that you are measuring, these tension landscapes, are not at all explained by changes in gene expression, or are you not suggesting?
That can be a contributor, but what I'm saying here is that in homogeneous population, the way it is defined in this field, if we take homogeneous cells, in that also you see this heterogeneity.
Okay, heterogeneous by the markers that you have been able to look at.
Yes, the homogeneity of cells by the markers that we have been able to. Yeah.
And this is a snapshot in time, right?
This is snapshot in time.
Right.
I'll come back to...
Yeah, that's going to be key, because
yes.
average over time, it could be that there's some average direction of the tension that's not showing up in a snapshot.
Yes.
This is okay. I didn't stop, but do you see any directional correlations? You say if you have a correlation then, but is there any, I mean, I'm thinking of things with only portraits, for example, are there things, what do they look like? Are they just, are they homogeneous, are they directional?
We'll come to that next. Yes?
Look at the confluent modulator.
Uh-huh.
These peaks, how long do these peaks take to go away?
Depends from cell to cell or what it is doing. But these peaks go away, come back, go away, come back. We have not really quantified this time scale over which this happens. But these peaks do not remain static. I will show you that. Okay. So this data I showed you is for endothelial cells. But what we also found is that this heterogeneity is also present in epithelial cells. So this is a rather generic feature, this rugged stress landscape. Now, the question that one would ask is like, so you are looking at scalar. What about the anisotropy? Right, every point we can get principal orientations, and we can find this maximum tension orientation. So what I'm going to show you now is the anisotropy through the stress ellipses. So the orientation of ellipse will tell you the axis of maximum tension, and it will also tell you the aspect ratio of the ellipse. The two axes will tell you how much anisotropy there is. Now the map that I'm going to show you here, I want you to pay very close attention, because this contains almost all information that we get from this technique. And there are three points that I want you to notice. First is the stresses are not isotropic. They are extremely anisotropic. And this anisotropy is also not uniform. You see that there are locations where the stresses are very anisotropic, and then there are locations where stresses are rather close to isotropic. And this degree of anisotropy also changes from location to location. And the second point is from the technique, about the technique. What you see here is these cells happen to be sort of elongated cell, in which you can imagine that the stress fibers would be along its axis. So if you are asked a question that given this monolayer, at this point, what would be the maximum tension orientation? Naturally, the answer is along the axis of cells. And this map, this ellipse map, tells you that the ellipses are aligned along the cell axis. So as you know, the image of the cell and the stress quantification are two independent measurements. But they match, and they kind of validate that the approach that we are using here is pretty robust. Yes?
What is spacing of your markers compared to the size of the cell?
They are in within a cell. We have so within a cell size, let us say typical cell size, we have at least 10 markers across the cell size. Here I've just shown them very sparsely to
so
make it.
You coarse grain with the size of the cell to calculate your ellipses.
No. I'm just displaying at this coarse scale. The calculations are done at much finer scale. The calculation, as I told you, means the data that I have is across.
The spacing of this grid that you chose to show the ellipses is roughly the size of the cell.
A little bit more than that, actually. Yeah. Just for visual clarity, I've spaced them apart.
If you displayed it within the cell, would you see differences in this orientation and in homogeneity?
There is slight, very slight changes within a cell. Yeah, we do see some change. But as you can see, like from this pattern, you see that the variation at this scale, even this scale, is rather smooth. So even at subcellular cell, you see variations, but it is smooth. But then it changes from location to location.
Can I ask another question?
Yes, absolutely.
Isn't there a standard method with polarization to visualize stress field?
There are bio markers, like people have developed this FRET sensors. Is that what you're...
If you just want to take a piece of plastic and like squish it and see the stress field,
that
can be done, you know, with cross polarizers or something.
Yes, absolutely.
So the question is, are the stresses big enough here to see them that way, instead of just measuring displacements and working backwards?
The stresses are big here, but I believe that that technique would require certain property for the material to exhibit that type of polarized pattern. Yeah.
Right. Is there another elastic solid we could use that would let us do direct photo stress imaging instead of backing it out from the displacements?
Perhaps that is possible, that you can image the forces that cells are applying on the substrate with some material like that, but I don't know of any material which would have that kind of stiffness and let that start type of measurement.
If you try to do this, is that you basically need to have a transparent material. You need to image from one side in one particular polarization, then it gets, I suppose, mostly turned inside the material and images across polarizers. So here, because the cells are on top, I don't see all this.
Well, if you can see the displacements, you just, I mean, how, aren't the cells kind of, I mean, how do you measure the displacements through the cells? It's easy to see through the cells?
Yes, as I told you that there are fluorescent markers.
Right.
So you just take fluorescent image of the fluorescent marker at different time point, and then you take out the cells, so the gel is now relaxed, and then you cross-correlate those images, and with cross-correlation, you can find how much displacement the gel has undergone.
So if you can see fluorescent markers through the layer of cells, can you not also see the light passing through polarizer and analyzer through your sample? I mean, I would think you could find a birefringent.
There might be, but I don't know of any technique that people have developed to make use of okay. that approach okay. to quantify.
Thank you.
The third point that I want you to notice here is, remember I told you that these principal orientations are also orientations of zero shear stress. So what these ellipse, the patterns that you see in this ellipse tells you is that so here I've just drawn by hand these lines just to guide your eye, is that there are these tracks which one can call that tracks of minimum shear stress. So in this stress landscape, you see this very nice tracks of minimum shear stress. So with this, let us summarize what we saw in terms of intercellular stresses. And the key points are that more than local event, the stresses comprise of cooperative events. And the cooperativity length scale here is 10 to 15 cells. Now, this cooperative event is strongly anisotropic, that also we saw, and it is heterogeneous. So if one thinks about these biosensors that that are recently developed, where you can find a displacement between the two points at any location and quantify forces from that, this anisotropy, this long-range order in the system, I want to tell you that this order is not static. So this type of anisotropy and this structure will be missed from those type of approaches, whereas this monolayer stress microscopy captures those features. And what else is that this heterogeneity is not a static. I've shown you time snap, but now I will show you movie. But just in advance, I want to tell you that this is not a static. This is a dynamic heterogeneity. You had some question?
Later.
Okay. So let's go to a force motion relationship. What does MSM tells us? And here, before we look at what MSM tells us, let us try to see if we can. So we looked at several over last couple of years, 2-3 years. We have been looking at this force motion relationship, and what we have found so far is that the relationship is anything but direct. And what we have done so far is this technique has uncovered a mine of exciting problems for theoretical physicists. So these are the things that we have done recently, and again, I will post these papers on the wiki so that those who are interested can take a look at it. What is very exciting is that all these observations that we have made appear to be converging in a single mechanistic framework of jamming. And this unification is also discussed in this paper. And for the constraint of time and to have a focused discussion, what I'm going to do is I'm going to focus on this plethotaxis. So before we look at MSM data, let us try and see if we can come up with an expectation for what this force-motion relationship can be. And this system has been studied in isolated cell, that they apply forces and they move. So let us try to see if one can come up with an expectation from isolated cell. So I showed you this experiment from Harris and co-workers, where this wrinkling of the substrate that they found, they were studying locomotion. What they found was that the fibroblasts adhere and they contract the substrate, so wrinkles are oriented like this, and the fibroblasts migrate perpendicular to these wrinkles. Few years later, Tim Oliver and co-workers, they looked at fish keratocytes. These are very beautiful cells. They are like shape of D, letter D. And so this is lamellipodia. So what they do is they have very high contractile forces along this direction. But this lamellipodia is actually pulling the substrate also, and they migrate along the wrinkles. So contraction is like this, and they migrate like this. So in single cells, what you see is that contraction is happening parallel as well as perpendicular to the axis of contraction. Now this lamellipodia is also present in monolayer cell sheets. So this is MDCK cells. And here, although you see very discrete cells, this is actually a confluent cell sheet. And only 10% of the cells are expressing, are transfected with this life actin. And what is shown here is basically, this is lamellipodium. Okay, and I will show you a movie where this lamellipodia will be marked either in red triangle with green triangle, and the green triangle would indicate locations where the lamellipodia is in the direction of motion, and there will be red triangles which will indicate lamellipodia in anything but direction of motion. It can be either to the left, right, or behind. So what you notice is that this picture that you get from single cell, that lamellipodia is the direction along which motion will happen. In cell sheet, you really do not come up with any such expectation that maybe the single cell model works, but no, it does not. And so one finds that this mechanical behavior of cell in isolation does not explain mechanical behavior in crowd. Yes?
If you label the actin with something like lifelike, you see these sort of pseudo descriptive lamellipodia different, do they have to express differently? Different amounts? Is it organized in any way, or is it more or less the same amount of cells?
So in this movie, actually, you are looking at life actin, and these thin structures are the ones, the thin structures shown here, these are the ones that are cryptic lamellipodia that are present underneath the neighbors. And their structure, they have different structures, as you can see from this movie, that different cells have different structure for their lamellipodia.
Even the levels of actin are distributed very uniformly across this?
Yes.
Vast number of cells?
Yes, yes. What else can we do to get an expectation? We have the map of tension that I showed you. Now let us see if the cells have this tendency of going from high tension to low tension. Right? That is a simple question one can ask. And here I'm showing you time, like time lapsed. So one of the things that you can notice from what I showed you previously, that these heterogeneities are not static, they are dynamic heterogeneities. And you can see that these peaks, they do not remain static, they change. And what you also notice in terms of force-motion relationship is that the orientation along which the cells are moving, this orientation, fluctuation in this orientation, spatial fluctuation in this orientation, is much less compared to spatial fluctuation in this tension. Which tells us that this simple idea that the cells are migrating down the tension gradient does not hold. Yes?
Yes, I'm confused about tension gradient because you say there's actually local force balance everywhere. How can you have a tension gradient? It means gradient of a tension, you would essentially have the divergence of a stress that gives you a local force.
Yes, but that's what. So the local force, so the tension gradient arises because you have tractions, the body forces acting in a certain way. So that's what gives you tension gradient, and that's
your body forces are it's stress by friction or the self-propulsion. I'm just confused of how to understand the different components of your stresses.
So propulsive force, I don't know if there is any well-defined term as a propulsive force, but what is well-defined is the force between cell and the substrate. Now, since the since the cell sheet is very thin, one can consider this force to be acting across the thickness of the sheet, and that's how it is a body force. So when one looks at this body force, if they have some sort of local systematic nature in which they act, one gets this type of buildup of forces.
But if you compute the tension gradient, do you include the body force or not?
Yes, that body force is what gives you this tension gradient. Okay, so let's talk it talk about it later. So so tension, so this simple picture also does not work. Now I showed you this anisotropy, and what turns out is a very beautiful picture when you take this anisotropy and overlap it with the motion. So this red arrow tells you where each cell is moving at that instant of time, and it fits pretty well. And what your eye tells you is that the motion is along this long axis of Phillips. And if you see this, yes? Yes?
When you say it fits well, you talk about the direction, right? You refer to the direction. The
oriented.
Size of the red arrow doesn't fit well to the size of the stress, or does it?
No. Size of stress, no. It is just the direction of motion.
And the direction of motion is a vector, so it's picking randomly one or the other? Or
yes, I will come to that. I will come to that. So here you can see that these ellipses, although they make this nice patterns, these patterns are not static patterns. These are also evolving as the monolayer migrates. But at any point, you can see with your eye that these cells are moving along these ellipses.
So far, you've chosen to tell your story with these stress maps on the substrate. Have you done an analogous plot of the motion of the cells? I mean, that's what one would do first, right? I mean, pick the cells, their shapes, and then ask what is it at one time step to the other, and plot the motion of that. Have you done that, or are you going to tell us later? The impression you have, because you showed these arrows.
You mean at
arrows in the next picture.
The cell stresses?
No, motion.
No, it is to show velocity, local velocity of the cells. I mean, this has been
done. Yes. I'll show you the data.
Later, okay.
So let us quantify this. This is what you are coming to, right? Like,
yes.
So let's quantify this.
Velocity, direction,
coefficient. Yes. That is precisely what I'm coming at. So let us see if this holds quantitatively. So what we have done is we have taken these ellipses. At every point, we can get this ellipse, orientation of ellipse, and we also know velocity vector. And we can find the angle between them and see how this angle is distributed across the sheet. And this is the rows plot for more than 8,000 data points. So let me just walk you through. So this is angle 0 to 90 degree. And this is the distribution of how this angle is distributed. And what you see is that it is very narrowly distributed to 0, which tells you that these are very tightly aligned. Now again, the motion is independent measurement compared to stresses. But what you see is that they have this very nice alignment that emerges from the system.
Excuse me, I see a 90 degrees over there on the left.
Yes.
On the left, around the middle height, right?
The ellipse is this way and the velocity is that way. They're not parallel.
Yeah.
So there are points which are along those axes. But if you put all the data together,
they're so rare, but it was so easy to find one.
So there is actually there is one more thing to it, okay? One more part which I will show you later, which is if you take this anisotropy of these ellipses. Okay, the more isotropic these ellipses are, the lesser the motion is aligned along those. Okay, and the more anisotropic the ellipses, the more tightly the motion is aligned along those. So one, it, this relationship comes out very beautifully.
Although the car again.
Yeah, they provide some exception.
So this I think is plot. Yeah, go ahead.
Bind instantaneously, just plot our input state in time a little bit when you do the binning of the alignment.
So what I've done is I've taken four different wells and four different times in each well, and then with all these points put together, this plot is generated. So it is different times, points, and different wells. What is striking here is this alignment is not very, it is rather intriguing, because this is endothelial cells which in this case happen to have some orientation, but this alignment is also seen in epithelial cells which do not have very clear morphological orientation. Now I just showed you that even the local cryptic lamellipodia does not explain if there is an alignment in epithelium. The cryptic lamellipodia does not explain such alignment. What more is that in this setup, we did not put any chemical gradient, that the cells would migrate from high to low chemical gradient. And neither is the substrate stiffness gradient in the system. So it is not durotaxis, it is not chemotaxis. So we call this phenomena as plithotaxis, with the Greek word plithos meaning crowd and swarm. And what this means is that a cell, in cells in the monolayer, have an innately collective tendency to migrate along either maximum tension or equivalently minimum shear orientation. I will come back to this innately collective in a few slides. They perhaps. Yes, but when you look at even deeper into the monolayer, we see this plithotaxis happening. So perhaps that might be very important in very leading edge, because there is sharp gradient, perhaps because of what cell is secreting. But much later in the cell sheet, this one would expect this to be stabilized. But there also you see plithotaxis.
So, have you tuned the cell solutions like adherence?
Yes, we have done that. Mm-hmm. I will show you one example of that, we have done several experiments. What we see is that if you reduce cell-cell adhesion, the cells cannot transmit force to its neighbor, this long-range cooperativity is gone, and this plithotaxis is also gone. So it necessarily needs this collective nature in motion. Yes.
Can you actually stretch the substrate and then yes. create a stress field and then the cells follow it?
So we are currently doing those experiments, and we are looking at how after stretching the cells fluidize and what happens after that, and whether cells regain their motion.
Are they? I'm not talking about stretching the cells. I'm talking about stretch the substrate, so that there is a pre-existing strain field in the substrate. It is stretched, and your thinking is that the cells are sensitive to that, that they feel the strain in the substrate, or they really only feel the strain in their own layer.
So this means that they are feeling forces within the own layer.
So they don't care about the strain in the substrate.
We have done some study where the strain in the substrate sensitivity is shown. So Angelini and co-workers across the river, what they did was they placed the cells, MDCK cells, on soft gel, and what they found was that as the cells become denser, there are swirls. These cells exhibit some local swirls. Okay, and as the density increases, the swirl size of cell increases, which is velocity. But simultaneously, you also see increase in swirl size of gel deformation. So as if cells are interacting to its neighbor through gel. So there is cell-to-cell interaction that is happening through the gel. And that also affects the neighbors.
Okay.
or the behavior of the migration. Yes?
I remember there's some literature on experiments and theory of cells moving in such a way as to minimize the average force on their nucleus. I'm wondering if you've thought about that, about somehow how this could relate to each cell moving so that it's reducing the force that it feels on its nucleus.
There is some similar inference that one can get from this approach, but we have not studied that in deeper. I will come to that point at the very end of the talk. Now, what is open is directionality, right? You pointed out that you have an orientation, right? And the stress gives you an orientation, whereas velocity is a vector which has a direction. So whether it is going this way or that way, this question remains open. And what about causality, right? There are stresses and there is motion. So maybe motion is leading to this stress, or maybe stresses are causing this motion. What is happening? So this causality is also remains an open question. Perhaps both of them are influencing each other. So with this idea of plethotaxis and this monolayer stress microscopy, let us take a real world problem. So this is the final set of slides that I will show you. This is a story of breast cancer metastasis, a very short story. So in this paper shown here, what they found was this ERBB2. They found this as an oncogene, metastatic promoting oncogene. What that means is that if you take this invasive tumors and non-invasive tumors, you would find more ERBB2 in this, overexpressed in this invasive tumors compared to non-invasive tumors. But in the field, when the tissue samples were taken and measurements were done, it was found that it was exactly opposite, that the non-invasive tumors had more ERBB2 compared to invasive tumors. So this was a paradox for a long time. And Liu and co-workers, they solved this paradox. What they found was that when you overexpress ERBB2 in a cell, then it acquires a couple of properties, namely increased proliferation and increased motility. What increased proliferation does is it gives cell ability to form a tumor. So you can form tumor. So they do form tumor because of ERBB2. But this tumor stays put until you have a second hit of overexpressing of another gene, 1433 zeta. So this activates this TGF-beta-1 pathway and stuff like that. But what it does physically is it reduces proliferation and it reduces cell-cell adhesion. Now, since they have reduced cell-cell adhesion, now the cells have chance to escape the tumor and then go and metastasize elsewhere. So the solution for this puzzle was that ERBB2 alone is not sufficient. You need the second hit. So that's why this paradoxical observations were made. Fortunately, we had a handle on this. We got these cells and we looked at the stress maps that one sees in this type of cells. And this will also come to the question that you had. So on the top are the normal cell, and here are the ERBB2 cell, overexpressing cell. And at the bottom are the cells overexpressing 1433 zeta. So again, these have higher proliferation, which kind of is seen from this difference in the two images. And these have reduced proliferation, but they have reduced adhesion. Keep that in mind. And for that, these are the cytoskeletal tension. For these two, what you see is the typical distribution that that the tension is increasing across multiple cells, which I showed you before. In case the data that I showed you earlier was endothelial, these are epithelial cells. But what you see for this last cell, where the cell-cell adhesion is weaker, that this tension landscape is flat. You don't see forces building up across multiple cells. This comes out of the measurements, and which is something that one would expect. What is even more interesting is that when you look at mechanical guidance, this rose plot that I showed you, you see that again, here I'm showing you epithelial cells that they exhibit plethotaxis. So there is plethotaxis here, but the cells that are proliferating more, you see that they exhibit even stronger plethotaxis. It is as if the cells proliferate, they make environment more crowded, and in this more crowded environment, there is more cooperativity emerging, which cages motion of neighboring cells. So this caged motion giving rise to plethotaxis. So maybe by now you would see how this jamming hypothesis comes into picture in this type of scenario, that the motion is caged by the neighbors. Now, what you see at the end is that when the cell-cell adhesion is weaker, there is no cell-to-cell force transmission, plethotaxis is completely gone. So for plethotaxis, you need long-range order, you need cell-to-cell force transmission, and here the metastatic cell lines, they do not have control from their neighbors, so they just go out and metastasize elsewhere. And what you also notice from this is that maybe this tool, the technique, monolayer stress microscopy, can be used to quantify in some sense this metastatic potential of cancer cells. So it kind of is a very useful tool, or maybe look at the state of cell-cell junction. So all these studies are going on now in the lab. So let me, yep.
Well, what happened if you had cell-cell adhesion that moved for the thoracic?
No what?
No proliferation.
No proliferation. We have not looked very deeply into it, but what we see is that the stress landscape is slightly lower, depending, means they do not migrate a lot in that state, mm-hmm. and the stress landscape is not high. The stresses are not very high. But is there any precise question you have in mind?
No. Right now.
Okay. All right.
How important is mycin?
It perhaps is very important because most likely that is what gives rise to these stresses or changes in stresses.
Have you used levostatin or something?
Yes, we have. And what we found, not in these experiments, but we have done that in an expansion of a strip. So the strip is doing this. And in that, if you put levostatin, or not put blebistatin, makes a huge difference. If you do not put blebistatin, you see some mechanical waves propagating from the free edge inwards. Okay. Now these mechanical waves are completely gone, although the sheet still expands if you put blebistatin, so myosin is not present. So the sheet is still expanding, the traction is gone, the intercellular stresses is gone, and this mechanical waves that propagate from free edge to inside, those mechanical waves are also gone. So this long range sort of guidance that is present in the system, it appears that these have mechanical origin, which has to do with these intercellular stresses. I didn't show you that data, but I can go to that. So let me summarize this talk by showing you a few fundamental questions that plethotaxis poses or identifies. Now, the first and foremost question is that from this heterogeneous stress landscape, how does this plethotaxis type of behavior emerge? This remains a very important and unsolved problem. Now, I told you that these ellipses are the orientations of zero shear. So one can think of this motion as migration along minimum shear. So cells seeking trajectories of minimum shear. So how does that come up? Is it so that the cell-cell junctions, they are not able to sustain any shear stresses? So coming to your question. And maybe that when they see any shear stress in certain orientation, they just slip and then they go into minimum shear orientation. So is there can cells support, can the junctions support shear stress is one of the very fundamental questions that this study raises. Another question is about cytoskeletal remodeling, which is precisely what you mentioned. So one can also hypothesize from this study, from these observations, that maybe what is happening in the cell sheet is that when the cell is pulling its neighbor, the cytoskeleton is remodeling. And the remodeling is happening such that it is governed by minimization of intercellular shear stress. So this remains an open question, that are such things happening in the system?
So I remember now more clearly this paper, these papers, I can't remember their authors right now, but they did a series of experiments and computer simulations where they showed that these group of cells would orient themselves in such a way as to minimize the, I guess, the total force on the nucleus. And so they showed the orientation process. It was not a pure mechanical thing. It was more of a response to a average shear stress that the cell was orienting towards. And so really that leads to the question, is this, I mean, are you trying to think of this as a mechanics problem, or do you think there's more than that going on here?
There perhaps is way more going on, because this nucleus, accessibility of nucleus and physical effects on nucleus seem to be very much determining forces as well as motion.
Yeah, as because, I mean, from a mechanics point of view, this whole problem is very similar to the kind of problems that people deal with in turbulence, which is they're measuring the complicated turbulent velocity field in a fluid, which is changing in time and which is typically very heterogeneous. And then from that, they're trying to infer or predict the motion of particles in this turbulent velocity field. Very, very similar situation. And in certain situations, they find that there are coherent structures that form and so forth and so on, but it's a very complicated problem, even if it's just pure mechanics, which it is in the turbulent case, whereas here, it could be much more than just mechanics.
Yeah, at least from motion, one kind of tries to think of whether turbulence type of processes are happening because of heterogeneity.
The tools are very similar.
Yes,
some of the
absolutely.
Tools are very similar. They're measuring shear stresses and trying to predict based on that. And it's difficult to take a time series of field of shear stresses and trying to infer what's going to happen to motion of a particle moving in that field. That is not a simple problem from a mechanics point of view, and this is clearly even less simple than that.
So yeah, with this I would like to take any more questions that you may have, and I can show you data in case like blebbistatin or other things that you want to see.
So you haven't looked at the time scale, the time correlations of these stress fluctuations at all.
So what I can show you is I can show you some data about that, and which is this, right? So here, what the experiments done here are basically, you have a polarized epithelium and then it is expanding. So as the time progresses, this is what is happening. And these are the velocity plots. This is the traction and these are the intercellular stresses. Now in this, this is what I want to show you in just time correlation of some sort. So if you look at the center of this sheet, okay, and see what is happening at this center as the time progresses. These are the strain gradients, the velocity gradient, sorry, the velocity gradient. And this is the change in area, and this is change in tension. This is what happens across time. And what you see here is really that these are in phase, but the stresses are not in phase with the velocity gradient. Now coming back to your point, this tells us that the stresses that are present in the system are dominated by elastic forces. And cell types are different, but we have looked at MDCK cells also, and we have not done similar study with endothelial cells, but just to give a snapshot of a cell type that is studied from that viewpoint, you see that the stresses are elastic in origin. So this is what has been done.
What I had in mind was more like, so you have these fluctuations, local stress, regions of high local stress that then eventually, say, die out, and then have fluctuations somewhere else. What's the time scale on which these local fluctuations die out, and do they correlate with any chemical signaling in the system, or I don't know?
We have not done that study. Another important point in from that viewpoint will be like when cell division event is happening, right? How does stresses fluctuate at that time? Is there any history dependence to this cell division event? So all of these still remain an open question. We have not investigated those in much detail. Yes?
Are there alternative clinicians which is, you have these arrays of microcalculus of 1 micron in diameter which are separated? Which is a better technique? And because there you don't have to do any inversions.
So both, so that technique has its own limitation. To name a few limitations is that these are typically looked at by just looking at the, so they have fluorescent surface, the top surface of the pillar, and you just look at where it differs. But if it twists, you do not know, you miss that twist. You have to have some sort of elliptical pillar. Beyond that, it requires microfabrication technique. It has its own overhead. And more than that, the most important thing from mechanics viewpoint is that the substrate, interaction through the substrate is very different compared to what you would have in a gel. Because these are pretty isolated pillars, one pillar compared to other. So when the cell is pulling here, it doesn't know that there is someone else pulling just next to it. So the interactions would be completely different compared to the gel. But like as you said, like one doesn't require inversion and stuff like that. So those are other differences which may or may not be preferable.
Yeah, in a biological context, epithelial cells are surface cells, right?
Yes.
So do we know anything about how they interact with the cell sheet below them? I mean, is it similar to the translation through the gel because it's similar stiffness, or do we know anything?
We know the field knows that how much is the stiffness in different regions of vasculature and different regions of this ducts. So people have measured this type of stiffness in several organs, and what people also know is what type of proteins are present in this extracellular matrix. Besides that, people have also studied what is the microstructure of these proteins. So all those things are known in the field. But from that viewpoint, we are looking at a very simplified system. In this also, I mean, we do not understand many things. Yes?
So are this intracellular stress the same or different than the stress in the substrate?
So stresses in the substrate are very different compared to the intercellular stresses, and they are related with this equation that divergence of the intercellular stresses equals the cell substrate stress divided by the thickness of the gel. It's kind of integral, means roughly speaking, this like integration of this cell substrate forces is what tells you the cell forces. Roughly speaking.
So if you plot those ellipses of the substrate stress, and you say any correlation of that stress with the velocity, motion, and the cell?
So these substrate stresses basically are nothing but tractions, right? So these are applied on an area, but these are just a traction. So they are not really a 2D tensor. But they have just two components, so you would not get an ellipse as such. Whereas the intercellular stresses, it is a 2D matrix, so which can diagonalize and you can get an ellipse, and then you can meaningfully do some correlation about these ellipses and the motion. Yes?
At your last point, you mentioned the remodeling of the cytoskeleton and the direction of smallest stress, so to speak. Now, is the time scale for this remodeling of the cytoskeleton comparable to the time scale for the cell to move, say, the time it needs to move a distance of order its own cells?
It's a good question, but what I presented there is rather a rough idea, because remodeling of cytoskeleton is not a very well-defined term. So the way you define it, one can make a statement whether those are comparable timescale or not. Of course, when the cell is moving, it has to have a certain structure inside it, right? and that structure has to change when it is changing position. So there is some sort of remodeling which is happening at the time scale of motion. So there is the answer to your short answer to your question is that there is remodeling that happens, actin remodeling that happens at the time scale of. There is some remodeling which happens faster than that, faster than what you would see from cell going from one location to another, and there is some that is happening probably at slower.
All right. More questions. Thank you.
Thank you.